Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been an up and down week for Bush and NATO, a week of bailout talk for mortgage holders and scary revelations about the airlines. In Bucharest, hot debate as NATO signed off on President Bush's missile shield, but rebuffed him on membership for Ukraine and Georgia.
NATO's door must remain open to other nations in Europe that share our love for liberty and demonstrate a commitment to reform. Seek to strengthen their ties with the transatlantic community.
On Capitol Hill, Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd laid out plans to bail out housing and mortgage holders.
For millions of people on Main Street who wonder whether or not the Congress is paying attention to their concerns, what's happened to their homes, to their economic well-being, this effort that we've put into the last several days, I think, is a major step in the right direction.
And shocking testimony in Washington from frontline inspectors that the FAA colluded with airlines to ignore safety checks. Here's Inspector Michael Mills.
Their response was a chilling telephone call where I was informed that the region wanted to keep this matter very quiet and low key. Within 5 days, I was removed from my position as office manager.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. With us from Washington today is the great Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. She's just out with her terrific new book, Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Thanks for joining us, Robin.
Always nice to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Washington is our old friend Charles Babington, political reporter for the Associated Press. Great to have you here, Chuck.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Charles, and Robin.
Let's get straight to it. Robin Wright, you watch the whole world. What's your top story this week?
Well, I think there are two, actually. President Bush's meeting in Bucharest with the NATO leaders and with his longtime ally, Vladimir Putin, was very interesting because the president did win major concessions in terms of rallying Europe after two terms of hefty debate over missile defense, one support for deploying missile defense apparatus in Europe. But he did not win support for something that was rather embarrassing, and that was winning agreement to get the Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. He had just come fresh from Ukraine, where he talked up the idea of bringing these former Soviet republics into the Western alliance, overriding the objections of Vladimir Putin. But France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and others objected and blocked the effort to admit these two important countries into NATO.
Robin, I want to look at both of those. Let's listen first to President Bush on the missile shield front. This is the president in Bucharest, where his plans were endorsed, a victory for the president. Let's listen to his line there.
We can only imagine the devastation that would be caused by a ballistic missile attack on one of our cities. So I believe strongly we have a responsibility to work together to ensure that such attack never comes to pass.
Robin, take us into this. And where Europe's, attention is these days? I mean, are they responding more to Moscow or to Washington? It seemed like sort of a split decision here. Putin has been very vocal against this missile shield, continues to be. And yet the president really wanted Ukraine and Georgia in, and Europe seemed to be paying attention to Moscow on that front.
Exactly. The Russians feel that the United States is really targeting them when it comes to missile defense, when in fact Washington is looking more at the dangers from a country like Iran. But Putin has made it clear that he takes this personally and has even threatened to aim Russian missiles at the system once it's up. This is something that's likely to be discussed when the two men meet over the weekend. So this discussion is not over.
And then what about the discussion within NATO? We hear these stories about a great big dinner where Angela Merkel, the head of Germany, was upset at President Bush's strident tone. What's the, inside the clubhouse conversation here, Robin?
Well, I think the Europeans feel that that Washington is pushing too hard, too fast. They did agree in the end to consider both countries for eventual NATO membership. Washington says they're going to talk about it once more when NATO meets in the fall. The Europeans say, no, that's a discussion that will happen down the road. The debate is not over. So there's a compromise on the table. The question is timing, and the Russians clearly are not going to be happy about this and may try to make it difficult on some other issue, hoping that the United States will eventually compromise and say, well, we'll shelve it for now.
Charles Babington, back in Washington, the mortgage conversation was hot and heavy. And what and how much Congress should do? Where does that stand at this point? Are the House and Senate plans on the same page, close enough? Is there something emerging here that may become reality?
Most of the action for now is in the Senate, Tom. They were not able to finish it up this week. No big surprise there because it is complicated. What strikes me is, you know, this Congress has been so bitterly divided along partisan lines for so long, and there's been so much gridlock. And we've seen this really over the years, just an inability to cope or to deal with really big issues like immigration and Social Security, what have you. And this is a case where fairly quickly at least at the beginning, the partisan divide seemed to melt away. You did not have what you usually almost always go through in the Senate, and that is some type of filibuster scenario that takes up days. And I think the reason is that people in both parties realize that this is a huge domestic problem and that it affects so many ordinary Americans, i.e. voters. And usually the political calculation up here is that if the Democrats feel that something would accrue to the Republicans' benefit, they're reluctant to do it, and vice versa. And I think in this case, both parties feel like, you know what, I can't predict what the political fallout would be if we do nothing, but I think it would be bad for all of us. So you are seeing, at least in the beginning, some action on this, and we could go through some of the details of it, but one thing that's clear from the beginning is that the Republicans and conservatives are getting their way on a number of things, and the reason for that, even though they're in the minority party, is that it's so much easier to stop, as you well know, so much easier to stop legislation than to make it happen. And whenever you have that, it really gives the minority a lot of power. When the more the majority wants something, the more power the minority has.
And maybe also they're feeding off the fact that Americans, if the polls are to be believed, are kind of divided on this. We've got this new poll out today saying 81% of Americans polled say the nation is on the wrong track when it comes to a mortgage bailout here, though it's 50-something for and 40-something against. Not exactly a runaway winner with the public, though a majority for it. Here's Republican Senator Norm Coleman of Minnesota, Republican, saying he's been hearing about housing woes from his constituents.
People concerned about their homes, concerned about their neighborhoods, concerned about their jobs, all being impacted by the subprime crisis, the devaluation of homes, the impact on neighborhoods. So we listened, we heard, and we actually have something unusual. I think we have a bipartisan agreement to move forward.
Charles Babington, what is this going to mean? Is it possible to put it in a nutshell? There's hope for home builders here. There's something for the banks here. There's supposed to be something for bad mortgage holders as well. But how many and what kind of relief?
Well, it looks like the biggest winners, if this legislation goes through, Tom, as it is now, the home builders certainly would come out well ahead. They'd be able to write off losses going back with new tax breaks. They'd get to write off losses going back 4 years, which obviously predates this crisis quite a bit.
But I thought the point was to help, you know, Ma and Pa Kettle, who had a bad mortgage and were in danger of being foreclosed upon.
There is some of that in here. There are some tax-exempt bonds, for example, that would let state and local governments refinance subprime loans. Supposedly that would keep some from going into foreclosure that have not gotten there yet. There'd be some money for counseling people on how to avoid foreclosure. There are some requirements for greater disclosure of these loans that, you know, have balloon payments and all that sort of thing. But the bigger items that a number of Democrats and consumer groups wanted, for example, a lot more money put into Federal Housing Administration loan guarantees for subprime loan refinancing is not in this. And they also wanted to allow bankruptcy courts. So if you do get as far as bankruptcy, they want the judge to be able to write down your obligations on the mortgage on your primary residence, and that's not in this bill either.
And, of course, we've got this whole outrageous airlines business, and the FAA will look at that. But, Jack Beattie, I want to come first to you. What's on your dance card? What's grabbing your attention this week, Jack?
Well, the FAA, you know, I couldn't believe the testimony I was watching yesterday, listening to these people from the FAA. It isn't atypical. It's not as if this is just some single story about one regulatory agency asleep at the switch. That really is the sort of understory of the Bush years. There has been and the public gets this. 40% of people in the Times poll say regulators were mostly to blame for this subprime mortgage mess, and they're right. And it began with the Federal Reserve, but also the administration. And I think that narrative about the Bush administration, that it is essentially whatever big business wants, big business has got, and the connection between that and campaign contributions, that story really has been muted. You don't hear it much on television because, of course, television is brought to you by the people who pay the bills to these campaigns. So I really think this, but this should bring it home to people. Here they and one of the FAA people said that the supervisor who didn't want to look further into this problem with Southwest, he looked to Washington, is the way he put it. He looked to Washington for a wink, and he got the wink, and Americans' lives were in danger.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Bush and NATO bailouts for mortgage holders. Outrageous airline safety lapses with the collusion of the FAA. Robin Wright is with us, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Her great new book is Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Charles Babington is here, political reporter for the Associated Press. Jack Beatty's here. We want to understand more about this airline business, but first we've got a caller on NATO. Andy in Cambridge, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if NATO is, we're talking about memberships to NATO and yeah, countries joining, but what's the importance of NATO in today's geopolitical landscape in the absence of the Eastern Communist Bloc and the in 2008? Is it still a viable organization that's supposed to prevent big things from happening?
Mm. And with its very evident failure to muster up a clean common front on Afghanistan and getting troops out there where they're needed, Robin, what about it? I mean, was the very purpose of NATO the background question this week in Bucharest?
Well, I think it's really important that we understand NATO is going through its own evolution, and we've seen during the Bush administration since 9/11 NATO's increasing role in Afghanistan. The United States cannot fight on two fronts at the same time, such enormous wars. And one of the things President Bush did get in Europe was a commitment for additional troops, particularly from France, which has long been kind of the outsider inside NATO, to send more troops to serve in Afghanistan. So that's a really important development.
They're going to serve on the east, so the U.S. can send troops south to help the Canadians who threatened to pull out if somebody didn't come and help them out there, as I understand it. Is that right?
That's right. And it's very important. I think other countries may follow suit. There'll be small commitments. France is 700. But the reality is that we can take any troops anyone can provide in Afghanistan because the Taliban has become increasingly strong. Without NATO in Afghanistan, the United States would be in real trouble.
But what about Andy's question? I mean, I don't know if the so-called threat from the east is gone. There's Russia with all kinds of action of its own lately. But, you know, the sense that the clear mission of the Cold War years is long behind us now, the cohesion of that time not so apparent. People have been calling NATO's very viability into question. Was that in the air in Romania, Robin?
I don't think so. The reality is the Europeans are looking at their own defense organization, which they want to work alongside NATO. The reality is the debate is really over the nature of threats. Where are they coming from today? The Bush administration is trying to say they're from different quarters, whether it's the Islamic extremists, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, or what Washington considers a rogue regime in Iran, that the United States is arguing in the post-Cold War world, we're still the world's most powerful and important military alliance. We just need to be able to redefine our mission and our capabilities to address the evolving threats.
Let's turn a little. Yes, Jack, I hear you there.
I was just going to say, apropos Matt's question, You know, it's, in some respects, NATO is an exorbitant anachronism, our participation in it, that is. We continue. It used to be about a half of our defense budget went into European defense one way or another. It's still a substantial fragment. You know, while Europeans take five-week vacations, while they're, you know, they have wage insurance, while they have all the amenities, including national health insurance, we pay for their defense, but for what, against whom exactly? And I think, you know, any relook at American, at America's position in the world today, with an eye on our domestic estate, would have to, I think, begin with an accounting about our involvement in NATO, our bases in Europe, our troops there. Why, after all these years, are we the Romans? Do we stay forever? And I think that.
But isn't it part of American security to be deeply allied with people who are far from our borders? Not, you know, right up against the shores of Manhattan?
Deeply allied is one thing, but paying for their defense is something else. It had justification when the Soviet Union was there. Who's the enemy now?
Jack makes an important point, but I would also argue that the interesting thing is that U.S. troops in Germany, for example, are used not to defend Germany because there is no threat any longer, but they're used, this is a staging post. It's much more convenient for us to have troops there to deploy in whatever hotspot it is, be it Iraq or Afghanistan, than it is to ferry them just from the United States.
Mm. Chuck Babington, I want to come to you on this FAA business. Let's listen to just a little sound out of Washington from yesterday's testimony before the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Here's FAA Inspector Bobby Boutrous. He said he's been raising safety issues about Southwest Airlines, just for one, for 5 years.
I have been raising the safety concerns and AD compliance for maintenance issues since 2003, on record and openly. I have followed the chain of command from my manager all the way to the regional office and the division management team. Every safety concern, every inspection finding has my name on it.
He's been raising it. They've been swatting it down at FAA. Minnesota Congressman Jim Oberstar, Democrat there, lashed out against the FAA yesterday, condemning what he called an egregious lapse of safety.
It is misfeasance, malfeasance, bordering on corruption. If this were a grand jury proceeding, I think it would result in an indictment.
Charles Babington, you follow Congress, you're there in Washington. What do you make of this? How and why could the FAA get what looks like so in bed with the airlines that they'd be giving a nod and a wink at what seemed to be fundamental safety checks?
It was compelling and even somewhat frightening testimony, Tom. We should say at the top that even Oberstar, the chairman of that committee who had the strong language, did say that Americans should not be afraid to fly commercial flights, that it has not reached that point. But, you know, going back to what Jack was saying earlier, you know, you see these pendulums in terms of regulation and the appetite for regulation. It's no surprise that, generally speaking, Republicans are less inclined to have regulation and Democrats are more inclined. That's been tenets of these parties for many years. And so we've had, you know, 7 years of a Republican administration. So if you look at things such as housing, mortgage financing, if you look at regulation of airlines, just to pick these two, you know, and we see that the pendulum sometimes swings too far one way and sometimes swings too far the other. I've got a feeling that the consensus that's growing probably in Congress and maybe in the public at large is that it swung too far towards the deregulation end now, and you'll start seeing some tightening up. You're already seeing it afoot in the housing world. Now look for it in airlines. And if a Democrat is elected president in November, almost surely, barring a huge surprise, there'll be Democratic majorities in the House and Senate. You'll probably see you'll see the pendulum swinging back towards more regulation.
It does seem to become part of almost a joke. I mean, a federal emergency management authority that can't manage emergencies, an EPA that can't manage the environment, FDA can't keep, you know, safe drugs out there. Let's go to Michael in Buffalo, New York. Michael, you're on the air. Oh, lost Michael. Let's go to... Oh, we're going way around the world. Priscilla in Quincy, Massachusetts, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to say that one of my top stories for the week was actually coming out of Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
With President Mugabe possibly moving out of the presidency. The fact that the country has been in turmoil for almost 30 years and the people have risen up to vote in a new parliament and possibly a new president is an amazing story for me.
It certainly is. And Robin Wright, you've got personal history there. Take us back and then right to the present just a little bit, Robin. Do you think we're going to see a change? Is Mugabe finally headed out or not?
Well, I think he's going to resist as hard as he can. It's an interesting story. I actually interviewed him the day after he was elected president in 1980, 28 years ago.
Wow.
He is now one of the longest-serving autocrats in Africa and any place in the world. Rhodesia, as it was at the time on the eve of becoming Zimbabwe, was considered a country that could be the breadbasket of Africa. It was a thriving country with enormous agricultural potential and a very well-trained academic community, skilled workers, arguably the best in Africa. And the tragedy today is that this is a country that is really broken on so many levels. Today, the government introduced a $50 million note, which is worth only one U.S. dollar.
Because inflation has been so stratospheric.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it increases, you know, on a monthly basis, and it is people really are struggling to survive. On the political issue, it's clear that Mugabe is resisting the reality of the tally. They're not even releasing the final totals. It's clear that the governing party has lost parliament, and it looks like he may not have gotten enough to even pull a runoff. Now, clearly, that's the best case scenario for him now, and that would give him a chance to rig the vote a second time around.
Robin, let's listen for just a second on that front and then get you to tell us what it means. Here is a spokesman for the main opposition party, Movement for Democratic Change, saying that the party had done its own tally of votes and that opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has won.
And what we are confirming, namely that Morgan Richard Tsvangirai is the next president of the Republic of Zimbabwe, and he will be so without a runoff. That means he's above the 50% threshold.
Robin, you know Zimbabwe. At this point, what decides this? Is it just a matter of Mugabe's security forces and their guns? Is there international pressure that matters here, or after all these years, is there not?
International pressure is unlikely to make any difference to Mr. Mugabe. He's begun to push his thugs back onto the street. People are using words like coup d'etat. It's clear that he wants to use whatever powers he has. Yesterday, he raided the hotel place I used to stay, in fact, where several of the opposition candidates had offices. He arrested Western journalists. He surrounded a hotel where many of them were staying. They picked up the New York Times correspondent. This is a regime that clearly does not want to cede any kind of power. And Mugabe is 84 years old. There are many who believe it's time for him to move on for a lot of different reasons, including his age. But he is resisting this, and this is, I think, the story is unfortunately probably not over.
Amazing. It may not be until, you know, Mugabe departs this earth. Who knows there? I want to turn to American politics a little bit. Economy very much in the news this week. Dow all over the place. Ben Bernanke warning recession may be on its way, maybe here, the employment numbers would seem to suggest. And this, in the ads, Hillary Clinton had her famous red telephone ad against Barack Obama, ran down in Texas and elsewhere. This week she's got an ad, once again featuring that ringing phone. This time, instead of Barack Obama, she's going after John McCain's economic policy.
It's 3 a.m., and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone ringing in the White House, and this time the crisis is economic. Home foreclosures mounting, markets teetering. John McCain just said the government shouldn't take any real action on the housing crisis. He'd let the phone keep ringing. Hillary Clinton has a plan to protect our homes, create jobs. It's 3 a.m. Time for a president who's ready.
It's 3 a.m. again in Hillary Clinton's ad land. John McCain responded with a 3 a.m. ad of his own, going after both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
It's 3 a.m. and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone ringing in the White House, and this time the crisis is economic. Home foreclosures mounting, markets teetering. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama just said they'd solve the problem by raising your taxes, more money out of your pocket. John McCain has a better plan. Grow jobs, grow our economy, not grow Washington. It's 3 a.m., time for a president who's ready.
It's 3 a.m. all over the economic world. Chuck Babington, what do you make of this contest? First, interestingly, here's Hillary Clinton aiming her fire not at Barack Obama, but at McCain. And then what? Is this a weakness, a vulnerability on the McCain front? How about his comeback, Chuck?
You know, when Ronald Reagan said it's morning in America, he meant the sun had come up. Right. In this campaign, it seems like it's morning in America, and it's always 3 a.m., and it's dark, and it's cold, and that scary phone is ringing. I think at some point they're going to have to move to a sunnier posture. It's a great ad. It plays to all our fears about our children not being safe and all that. Now I think it's almost become a parody of itself. I do believe that the McCain ad, unless I'm mistaken, ran just on the internet, so it's not really going to be that broadly seen. But of course, for now, he doesn't need to be advertising like that. It is interesting, I think, that Obama and Clinton sort of keep going back and forth between aiming fire at one another and aiming fire at McCain, not just on this issue, but other issues as well. And perhaps that's not surprising because at the same time, they're trying to convince Democratic voters in these handful of states that have yet to vote that, number one, they're the better against each other, you know, Obama versus Clinton. But the way to prove that is I would be the better candidate against McCain. So in a way, it's sort of a two-front war. It is a little bit jarring if you try to follow the campaign. And it seems somewhat more pronounced in Hillary Clinton's case that it's almost hard to follow, you know, who exactly is she attacking? And sometimes she's really hitting, you know, Barack Obama hard, shame on you, Barack Obama, and that sort of thing. Then the other days, she barely mentions him, and it almost seems as though she's already the nominee.
Jack Beatty, there was this interesting, very interesting story in the Wall Street Journal this week about big business donors bypassing John McCain, the Republican candidate, and giving many times more in many industries to Clinton and Obama.
Yeah, and it pointed out that the Chamber of Commerce ranked him number 40 of 47 current Republican senators in being business unfriendly. And it pointed out why. I mean, he was against the oil and gas interests by opposing new drilling in Alaska. He's championed global warming legislation. He supports the importation of cheap prescription drugs. Drug manufacturers don't like that. Help pass a fuel efficiency increase. Car manufacturers don't like that. Wanted to regulate tobacco, on and on and on. He's been against what you might call the corporatist drift of the Republican Party, if more than drift, under President Bush. And yet on the other side, the public in a latest poll, this Times poll, sees him that 53% think he would favor the rich. 13% think Obama would. While McCain has this anti-corporate and anti-big business record, according to one calculation, 59 various lobbyists have been raising money for him, and his campaign staff is honeycombed with lobbyists. It came out, too, this week. Elizabeth Edwards said that her condition and John McCain's condition, his cancer, would not be covered under the McCain health care plan.
And the melanoma that he had.
Melanoma, a pre-existing condition. And in fact, that camp, as Paul Krugman points out in today's Times, that's probably true. So there's a picture of John McCain as somebody who, in his record, has really been independent of this corporatist streak and has come down hard against the big business, and they're making him pay for it by not giving him contributions. But on the other hand, he's surrounded in his campaign by lobbyists.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, Late Night Roast, and a big deal for rapper Jay-Z this week. David Letterman had some choice words to describe candidate John McCain.
He looks like the guy who's always got wiry hair growing out of new places. He looks like the guy who points out the spots they missed at the car wash. Right over there, you get the thing.
Walking on stage, John McCain then had some choice thoughts of his own on David Letterman.
You look like the night manager of a creepy motel.
Well, that's what I mean.
And you look like the guy who enjoys getting into a hot tub and watching his swim trunks inflate.
Everybody's joking. Hillary Clinton greeted Jay Leno last night with a hair-raising, self-mocking tale of getting to the show.
Good to see you.
Oh, it is so great to be here. You know, I was worried I wasn't going to make it.
Oh.
Yeah, I was pinned down by sniper fire.
Really? Right out here? You know, in L.A., that might be true, actually.
Wow, wow, wow. And superstar rapper Jay-Z says so long to his old label after scoring a record-breaking $150 million deal with concert promoter Live Nation. Here he is with Show Me What You Got.
Show me what you got, little mama. Show me what you got, pretty lady. Show me what you got.
Robin Wright with us from the Washington Post, Charles Babington from the Associated Press, and Jack Beatty's here. Charles Babington, Show Me What You Got might be the theme of some of the what we've seen on the campaign trail this week. John McCain talking a lot about himself and his potential and his hunt for a vice president, his age, his military background, biography week for Mr. McCain.
That's right. He's dealing with the age situation, Tom, head on. He's 71 years old. If elected, he would be the oldest president ever to take office.
On
day one, exactly. Mm-hmm. And he's dealt with this. He often says, "I've got more scars than Frankenstein, and I'm older than dirt." I think he's made a calculation that there's no point in trying to hide this. And even the other day, when talking about the importance of picking a good vice president, he said, "I know this is extra important for me because of my age." I think, people feel, is that a smart thing to do or not? The calculation he's made is it's going to come up anyway, and we might as well just hit it head on and show that I'm not afraid to talk about it.
Here he is this week on Imus in the Morning saying he's begun to make a list of possible VP candidates, rumored to be about 20 people long.
I'd like to get it done as early as possible, and I'm aware of the enhanced importance of this issue given my age.
Robin Wright, whatever his age, you must have been thinking as President Bush was in Bucharest this week about John McCain's recent speech on foreign policy, unilateralism, multilateralism. If he should get in there, he's promising to change the kind of face George Bush has shown Europe and much of the world.
It's been interesting to see John McCain try to carve out a foreign policy that makes him quite different from George Bush on everything but Iraq. Mm. He gave a very bold speech in which he talked about not wanting to go it alone anymore, creating a new global compact, deepening and strengthening our alliances. He talked even about, on the case of Russia, evicting it from the group of eight of wealthy industrialized nations because of its meddling in everything from cyberspace to not going along with us on missile defense. So it's very interesting how John McCain is trying to carve out a separate identity, because there are so many who say he's just another George Bush, and he's trying to strike out and give himself a different kind of foreign policy complexion.
Jack Beatty, he's been different all along the way on issues of torture and Guantanamo. Some news on that front that you've been following this week.
Yes, there's another John Yoo memo that surfaced, this one also about the treatment of detainees and about the Fourth Amendment on a ban on searches, unreasonable searches and seizures and such, not applying to them, and an article in the current Vanity Fair, really eye-opening, about the whole torture picture at Guantanamo and then the contagion to Iraq, and the article features a scene that hasn't been reported before in 2002 of Alberto Gonzalez, then the president's lawyer, David Addington, who was Cheney's lawyer, and several others coming down to Guantanamo and watching some of the procedure that was going on a particular person, I'm not sure who, and saying and telling people there, do whatever needs to be done. And then it goes on into a lot of detail about what was done to this particular prisoner. And the Geneva Convention criminalizes complicity or participation in torture. Now, we now have the president's lawyer in down there, basically seeming to approve techniques that, by any humane standard, are torture. He's the president's lawyer. And the president, of course, has taken him out of the loop for responsibility with this Military Commissions Act. But the issue is international travel. When these lawyers go abroad, is some court going to find them and prosecute them for war? Is the president himself ever going to face international prosecution for war crimes? This is the kind of question, it seems to me, Americans haven't wanted to look at, because it's so deeply unpleasant. But this kind of reporting, I think, raises it to the 10th power.
Robin Wright, what about it? Can you picture that? I mean, we know the tensions between the U.S. and Europe, but can you see John Yoo and Hancuffs in The Hague?
No, not realistically. I think this is an issue that a lot of people are going to be watching their backsides, perhaps, but I don't think they're going to push it that far, at least that's not the way it seems at the moment.
Charles Babington, let's stay on politics here for a second. We had Jay-Z singing Show Me What You Got There, and we've got new numbers on campaign fundraising this week. It looks like Barack Obama raised, what was it, $40 million in the last month to Hillary Clinton's $20 million. They're both huge figures, but Obama at twice the rate of Clinton? How's that being interpreted?
They're stunning figures, Tom. What's continued to go on is that Obama is raising so much money over the internet, relatively small contributions from lots and lots of people. More than 1 million people now have contributed to him. It gives him an advantage in so many ways, not the least of which is he doesn't really have to spend time at fundraising. This is pretty much coming just from appeals that, you know, his campaign sends out, or even you know, just spontaneous, whereas Hillary Clinton is having to do it the more traditional way, excuse me, holding, you know, fundraisers, taking time off the campaign trail to do that. And the other thing is when you have a relatively small donor, you can keep going back to that person. They don't max out. You know, the $2,300 is the most you can give. So they can keep asking that person, well, give us another 100, and real often they do that. I'd like to say one other thing, Tom, as long as we're on the...
Yes, please.
It's a fascinating campaign. It's one of the most... It's just endlessly fascinating. But what you've got going is, you know, this... continued battle between Obama and Clinton, with only a handful of campaigns left, and it's you just have to wonder how it's going to play out. But this notion that, by almost every account, barring a total meltdown by Obama, Hillary Clinton will not be able to overtake him in the pledged delegates, and almost surely in the popular vote. But if she continues winning, you know, say she wins Pennsylvania handily, she wins Indiana, maybe even wins North Carolina, which is possible, then, you know, this thing is going to end up with her on a winning streak, him on a losing streak, but him still, you know, holding more delegates. And I think these superdelegates who have not made their decision yet are going to have a terrible decision to make, because she'll look like she's, you know, surging and he's fading. But to tip the nomination,
reach back
to
him even at that moment, yeah, could feel very strange. But I'm looking at an LA Times count here, and I mean, you're quite right. We could be facing just that. At the same time, they're talking about Hillary Clinton's lead in superdelegates steadily narrowing. 106 superdelegate lead in December, 87 in February. As of Thursday, by their count, it was 30. We've got Jimmy Carter, you know, murmuring about Barack Obama and maybe going in that direction. I don't know how much difference that makes. But, you know, could she end up with, I don't know, behind in all the categories and still be considered the front runner somehow?
No, the superdelegates will decide it, Tom. But these, you're exactly right that over time there have been more have been coming out for Obama, but they've been coming out in dribs and drabs, and there hasn't been that big block. People keep talking about, oh, there's going to be a big block of superdelegates who will come out on the same day. That has not happened. The sense I get is that it will not happen anytime soon. I think if Obama can, certainly if he won Pennsylvania, the ballgame would be over. Probably if he won Indiana and then North Carolina on the same day, it would be very, very difficult for Hillary Clinton. But if she keeps winning, let's say she wins those two, then it's going to be the party's going to have quite a dilemma on its hands.
No kidding.
And to tip the nomination away from Obama, you can imagine the reaction that would, especially in the African American community, and understandably so. I think the party would have tremendous problems on its hands.
Howard Dean, chair of the Democratic National Committee, praying that it doesn't go to the convention. Here he is this week on CNN saying he wants to resolve this contest before August and that convention.
I'm not here to tell the superdelegates what they have to do. That is their job, and the rules say they can do whatever they want. I'm just asking them to make their preferences known before the convention starts so that we have adequate time to prepare ourselves for the general election.
Let's take a call from Essex, New York, and Susan. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to mention, and this kind of goes along with McCain-Add, there's a real irony to it. His chief economic advisor, who is Phil Graham, was actually one of the people who was responsible for the deregulation of the Depression-era laws with the landmark Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. And, in fact, shortly thereafter, Graham left Congress to take a vice chairman position with a very large investment firm, UBS. And he actually, while he was working for them, he lobbied Congress and the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department about banking and mortgage issues, and pressing Congress to actually roll back some of the strong state rules that sought to stem the rise in predatory tactics that were used by lenders and brokers.
And yet, you know, Susan, again, from this story we cited earlier, financial services, insurance, and real estate companies are now backing Obama with money almost 2-1 over McCain and favored Senator Clinton by even more. What do you make of that? If Phil Graham's in his camp and, you know, has been such a friend legislatively or was to financial services, you know, the hedge fund gang and all the rest, why wouldn't they be supporting John McCain more fully?
I'm not sure on that count, but I think one of the things that actually needs to be looked into is the lobbying efforts that are being done by these, by the industries. And I think that there's an awful lot of corruption that can occur. I mean, you know, when the act was repealed, it was a $300 million lobbying effort. So, you know, the lobbying effort in itself should really be looked at.
Yeah, it's a good point. We've got another call on the same front. Let's go to Pompano Beach, Florida. And Jay, hi, Jay, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to know how much money does the head of Bear Stearns walk away from this deal? I think his name is Alan Schwartz.
From the Fed and J.P. Morgan coming in, I don't have an answer to that off the top of my head. I don't know if anyone does. I remember at one point when it was $2 a share, his stake had gone from up toward $1 billion down to something like $13 million, and then it went up to $10 a share, or there was talk of that a week or two ago, which would put him back in the $100 million frame. Not too shabby. I don't know what the final number here is. Chuck Babington, is that getting talked about in Congress these days, or are people just agreeing with Ben Bernanke that he had to do the bailout to save the whole economy, and, well, then whoever gets, whatever gets?
My old friend Dana Milbank in the Washington Post did a column on this today, and I don't have it right in front of me, but I think Schwartz, what he'll come away with is enough money that he won't be having to take the subway anytime soon. It's a lot of money. And the column also pointed out just that despite that, that so many of the members of that of the committee that had the hearing yesterday with Bernanke, including Chris Dodd, the chairman of the banking committee, said, we think this step was necessary. It was the right thing to do. So there's not a lot of condemnation from Congress, even from the majority members of Congress.
But if this is the punishment that's supposed to guard against the moral hazard, $100 million doesn't sound like too much of a weapon. Let's go to Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I would say the story that grabbed the attention for me was the latest chapter in that slow train wreck in Iraq. It's just heartbreaking to see what's going on in that country and all the spin around the escalation and to remember this in parallel with Vietnam and just see the same tragedy, the same spin. There's no government in that country. It's a total train wreck, and we're not going to do anything to change it. I think we're just going to stick it out, and more people will just die, and it's just heartbreaking, totally heartbreaking.
Right. Sam, let us look at it while we've got the time. Robin Wright, of course, we've got David Petraeus and the U.S. ambassador to Iraq testifying next week in Washington. We've seen everything that went on there in Basra and beyond. I've got news here just now. Secretary of Defense Gates saying the U.S. intends to send more troops to Afghanistan in 2009 next year. But what about Iraq in the last 10 days, Robin? What we've seen, what can David Petraeus say when he sits down before Congress next week?
Well, the timing of this operation is very curious because of the testimony due next week, which will be so pivotal in defining what the United States does in terms of a further drawdown later this year. The reality is that even though we got a temporary truce, the issues have not been settled among the various Shiite factions, part of whom run the government and the other who represent the most significant opposition. The more than 1,000 troops, and including more than a dozen officers, basically did not fight. They opted either to stand back or to walk away from the conflict in Basra.
And Robin, if I understand correctly, you've said that you think, suspect, have heard that this ceasefire was brokered to give a kind of, to clear the smoke while Petraeus was back in Washington. That what, they talked to Muqtada al-Sadr and said, help us out here, we're going back to testify, we don't want gunfire while we're sitting on Capitol Hill?
Well, there's some reports about that. The interesting thing is that the critical party in negotiating the ceasefire was Iran. A group of Shiite lawmakers from Iraq went to Iran to get help from the Revolutionary Guard commander, as well as Moqtada Sadr, who runs the militia that the army was after and who is now residing in Tehran. And so that was pivotal. It's clear that the United States was not fully briefed on the outlines of this operation. Several top U.S. officials acknowledged that they didn't know about it until a few days beforehand. And in the end, things went so badly that the U.S. and the and Britain had to deploy troops and use air power to help the Iraqis. But the problem has not been solved in the truce. The Moqtada Sadr has demanded that his troops be allowed to continue having their arms and not be prosecuted. There basically be an amnesty. And the government is not willing to do that. The militias in the South are one of the main threats in the run-up to elections in October. This is going to be an ongoing story as well.
Surely some very tough questions for David Petraeus when he sits down next week, and we will be all over it. Robin Wright, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent for The Washington Post, author of Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Robin, wonderful to have you with us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Charles Babington at the Associated Press. Great to have you back, Charles. Talk to you soon. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, great as always to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.